Welcome to Shorts Season 3. I'm Jen Thomas. I live in New York, USA.
And I'm Lizzie Falconer, and I'm in Portland, Oregon.
We are two long-distance friends who want to talk about what we're reading.
This podcast is about how reading short stories can show the world through different perspectives.
Today we're reading Ophelia by Brianne McIver. It was published in April 2017 on Ada, the online literary magazine of the Commonwealth Short Story Prize. We've linked the story in the show notes.
Brianne McIver is a fiction writer from Diego Martin, Trinidad. She is a former national scholar who studied English at the universities of Cambridge and Edinburgh. She has been shortlisted for writing prizes, including the Derek Walcott Writing Prize in 2005 and the Fish One-Pager Prize in 2010. Brianne published a book of short stories, Where There Are Monsters, in 2019, and a novel, The God of Good Looks, in 2023.
Ophelia is a story about a young man who falls for a woman in the cast of a play he's in. As he prepares for a coffee with her, which could be their first date, he realizes the distance between them and decides he can't go through with it. This is a story about class, about race, and how to navigate who you are.
Hi, Jen.
Hi, friend.
How are you?
I am doing well, and I'm very excited about reading this story. And I think the reason is it took us a little while to find a story that we got really excited about. I think our listeners know that we don't read and discuss stories that we don't love or that kind of don't speak to us in some way. And I feel like we read a lot of stories, some of which were very good, but maybe we couldn't find a really exciting hook that pulled us in. And then we found this story, which isn't super recent, it's from 2017, but I was really excited to get on the mic and discuss it with you.
Me too. This is a new author to me. I have not read any of her work in the past, so that's always fun to find someone new whose work you love. And I'm really excited to have another Caribbean author and to dive into that world and that voice. So definitely excited about this one today.
And I think our last Caribbean story that we discussed was also from a writer from Trinidad, right?
I think so. Passages.
Yeah, really excited and a really interesting story. Should we start by talking about the title? I feel like we are famously terrible for ever mentioning the title of any story or the significance that it has. But this one really struck me. It's the title. It's one of the main kind of characters. It's obviously the fixation. It's also the first word of the story. Mm-hmm. What do you know about Ophelia? About any connotations around Ophelia?
Not much. I have to say my Shakespeare knowledge is pretty limited. So I obviously understood that it was a reference. And they lay it out a little bit for us in the story, but I'd love to have you tell me more about that.
I'm so happy that my 3 years studying English and theater studies is finally paying off, friends.
This is it.
When my parents were saying, "Oh, how's that going to help you in your life?" This is how. You just wait 20 years and then
teach an American about Hamlet.
Launch your own podcast so you can talk about Hamlet for 30 seconds. So Ophelia, as you say, is a Shakespearean character. She's from the play Hamlet. And she's a very interesting character. So she is this noble woman. She's presented as a sort of beautiful, innocent, virtuous woman who is perceived to be totally in love with Hamlet, who's this main character. And then through the play, I mean, spoiler alert, if you haven't seen Hamlet, I apologize in advance. As we go through the play, Hamlet, who is in this absolute torture of position because his father's died, his uncle killed his father in order to marry his mom, and the whole system is like very intense. He's kind of driven mad by this horrible thing that's happened to his family, and in trying to unpick all of that, he also unravels himself and completely drives Ophelia mad, is essentially how it rolls. And there's an implication, although it's not made totally explicit in the play, that she kills herself. And she certainly dies at the end of the play, apparently through this sort of madness.
Oh.
So this is a character that has this very rich story, but definitely is this kind of untouchable, noble woman when we meet her at the beginning of the play, and the object of kind of love and lust of Hamlet.
Oh, well, that's... Thank you, Jen. I feel embarrassed that I don't know that much, so I really appreciate your explanation.
Thank you very much.
Hopefully I'm not the only one listening who doesn't know. But that's very interesting because of who we immediately know Ophelia to be in this story, which is a real object of his desire, his lust. Like, she is his worldview, almost. Like, his thinking and his plans in this entire story revolve around her and her beauty.
Yeah, and the beauty is interesting because also the writer uses a lot of nature and a lot of natural imagery to describe Ophelia. So the story opens with, "Ophelia's words are sprinkling, tinkling in my ears. They smell like cut grass, just washed with rain. I want to breathe her, strip her, peel her skin like sunlight strained through cinnamon, and get to the heart of the woman that is buried under her layers of poise."
I mean,
slightly creepy obsession thing that begins. When I started, I was like, "Oh, what? Where is this going to go?"
The strip her. I think at first it's beautiful, right? Her words are sprinkling, tinkling in my ears. Who doesn't want to hear that the words they're saying are like poetry or, you know, that to someone? And then immediately I want to breathe her, strip her, peel her skin like sunlight. Uh-oh, danger. Danger.
But what's interesting is, and then I will stop talking about Shakespeare because it's not why listeners have tuned in. But Ophelia herself as a character in Hamlet is also very closely associated with nature. So there's a lot of natural nature imagery that's used. There's a scene where she kind of lists, she's talking a lot about flowers. There's a lot of that language that I wonder if the writer is kind of mimicking purposefully here. It feels like she is. And she also talks about the woman buried under her layers of poise. And that's another thing that Ophelia is kind of accused of by Hamlet, is Hamlet sort of very rude and kind of awful with her in some ways, but he kind of accuses her of being like stone and sort of very closed off to him because he's going through this kind of torturous emotional mayhem.
Oh, that's fascinating.
So there's definitely a connotation that's being pulled here.
Oh, it's so fascinating because throughout the story, we don't know much about Ophelia at all. Mm. What we know about her is the visions, the descriptions we get from the author, from the narrator. And she seems and feels almost untouchable.
Right.
Her beauty, her upper class nature, she's separate from him in so many ways. And he's always contrasting his own situation, his looks, his life, his where he lives, his neighborhood to her.
Yeah.
So it's amazing what's done already in that first paragraph.
Yeah, absolutely. And this distance between them, you know, Hamlet and Ophelia never are together, right? They never get together in the play. So you do also think, you know, is this, there's so much of that gaze of him to her, that distance is there right from the beginning. And you were saying that she's seen as untouchable. There's literally a line where he says, "Touching her would feel like the sun hitting my face first thing in the morning, like a piccolo playing notes that hum in my throat, like waking up after 8 hours sleep." So he's literally imagining touching her, but whilst maintaining this sort of gaze on her, it's all from a distance, it's not kind of close. And then I'm totally jumping ahead, but when we get to the end and he sort of feels like actually he can't get close to her, he sees her in the coffee shop, but he can't go and talk to her because he feels so not worthy, because he's sort of sweaty and he thinks his breath smells and he's not clean, so he has to keep that distance. And it's really heartbreaking from the beginning that this distance is never quite closed.
That's exactly right. He's just so infatuated with her. Mm-hmm. And the infatuation, as we'll talk about, becomes something that stops him. Like, it overwhelms him. It makes him feel worse. It highlights these aspects of his life that are really, really difficult. And this fantasy of her is, sometimes it feels like it's his way to escape his really difficult circumstances. So we meet Ophelia with these beautiful lines, and then we're set in the National Academy for the Performing Arts, and they're there together reading their lines. Ophelia is on her cell phone making arrangements to go to the spa. So we know she's got some money.
Yeah, she's rich. And then a little bit later, he talks about her new car, right? She's got a new Honda Civic. We've all had that feeling where we really, really like someone and we're not sure how to kind of make the approach. And that's kind of what I thought was going on at the beginning, until we start. And I love the way that the writer just drops this in, little clues, like you're saying, the spa. When he describes how he relates to his own character. So she uses these little ways of giving us clues that they are not of the same world, even though they're here and they're kind of in this world of the play together.
Mm-hmm. The play has brought them there, and the play obviously leaves, you know, the theater, acting, that's really Marcus, our main character. Mm. That is his passion. I think he, even when he's thinking of Ophelia and he starts to kind of ask her to go to coffee under the premise of rehearsing their lines, he's imagining, as he's having this real conversation with her, I can hear myself, to be or not to be, that is the question. My words are choking smoke that heralds the start of a fire, whether 'tis nobler in mind to suffer. And she interrupts him, Marcus? Because he's just lost in thought. He's like, so sweet. I really love our main character as he's romantic, he's creative, he desperately longs for this life of theater and desperately longs for Ophelia.
Yeah, and I love that section where he talks about his love of theater. Like, he talks about the love of her and the love of theater, and they're very much in the same sort of language. I mean, he is intoxicated by the arts. You know, he goes to see that first play and he was like, right, that's it, you know, there's only one job for me, it's acting. And he's so emotional and open, kind of in his inner monologue with us, the reader, that I agree, he's so sweet, he's very endearing. None of the creepy stuff that I was worried about in paragraph one comes true. And he's also very sort of down on himself in a way that makes me just want to kind of just be incredibly kind to him. You know, we heard the description that the way that he is describing her, the way he's describing Ophelia. And then when he describes himself, he says, dark and scrawny, like a weed springing up from a pavement crack. And she's this kind of cut grass on a after light rain, you know, and he's just not seeing himself the same way. And that already just sets up a very compelling and a character I really want to empathize with.
And he asks her to coffee and she says yes. She says, sure, that sounds like a treat. And then we're back in his inner monologue. Could she hear the vibrato in my voice? Would she taste my desperation if we kissed? That sour morning aftertaste that I can never brush out of my mouth. I won't mess it up. I won't think crazy thoughts in my head, all mixed metaphors and fantasies spilling from one part of me to another while I remain tongue-tied. Sweet boy. He is lost in it. He is being very brave asking her out here, but he's terrified. He's terrified to be seen.
He's done such an incredible thing by asking her out. And then the self-doubt, as you say, comes in. But you're right. It is brave. I couldn't get over this line. And this is something that comes up again. Like, would she taste my desperation if we kissed, that sour morning after taste? He talks a lot about the tastes in his mouth, his breath. There's another line where he talks about, like, somebody says something about his stink breath. And at the beginning, I just thought, oh, you know, what's happening there? But as the writer just unravels these clues, we understand that he's hungry. He's hungry. They don't have always have water at home. When he gets home, they've got no kind of running water. The sort of dryness, that idea that breath he can't get out of his mouth. It's like this. That's not him. He's not necessarily talking metaphorically. He could actually be talking the reality of his life and how he knows that this is a problem that he can't overcome, because it's a problem of his circumstances. It's a problem of his poverty. It's a problem of the house that he has that he's living in, and the money that they don't have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they're in Trinidad. I spent some time with the different places they mention in the story, and it's clear that he's in the neighborhood where the author actually grew up, Diego Martin in Trinidad. And beyond what you said about the circumstances, he doesn't have hot water. He doesn't have running water all the time. He's walking everywhere. They don't have a lot of money. He's hungry. Like, these things add up to making it difficult to be clean and smelling fresh. Yeah. But also, it's hot in Trinidad. It is humid. You are sweating. And so part a privilege in living in a place that has that kind of heat and humidity is access to being able to bathe all the time and be as clean as you want when the weather outside is the way it is. So I think it's just such a good point. Like, these things that he's worried about, his smells, how he looks, how he's going to taste, we can all relate to it because we've all been on dates. We've all been teenagers, you know, but also it is where he lives and the challenges that he faces.
Yeah.
Bless him.
And we learn more about the extent of the issues that he's having when he leaves the rehearsal. He gets into a taxi. They won't take him all the way home because they don't want to go into certain parts of the neighborhood because they're not safe. And then we meet his mother, and we hear that she's essentially lost her, I think she's lost her job, or she's certainly been sent home early because she wasn't sort of doing a good enough job. And so these issues sort of pile on and pile on, and you can sense his discomfort. But there's this beautiful moment where he's kind of looking ahead. He starts to kind of daydream about his date that he's going to have with Ophelia. And his mum says, "You listening to me?" And we get the same thing that we had earlier, where he's like, "Yeah, no, absolutely not." And again, just these kind of moments of full relatability in this story, which I love. Like, mum's chatting about something, I've lost interest already. I'm looking forward to this date and excited and terrified about it. It's just wonderful.
It's really sweet, because he's walked home, and as he was walking home, we, just like you said, we're in his neighborhood. He's hungry even then. You know, his feeling of hunger runs through this whole story. And it's not light hunger. It's intense. He is hungry, but he can't afford to buy some pawpaws from the vegetable stand because he's saving up, because it's $25 for a coffee at the Jardín where he's going to go meet Ophelia. And he's sacrificing. But even in these moments, he's dreaming about what could be with Ophelia. You know, right as his mom is still talking, he's thinking, "Please, please, God, give me this just one date. Give me an hour to untie my tongue so Ophelia can know me when someone else's words aren't in my mouth. Give me the chance to let go of this hill and Diego Martin for 1 hour."
Oh, I want it. I want you to have it too, Marcus.
I do too. I do too. Which is why it's just so devastating, all of these things that get in his way from having this hour.
suddenly it's Saturday. That's the feeling I got. I don't know how many days passed, but like suddenly we're at the day. And it's a very, what sort of should be the beginning of an exciting day for him. It just couldn't start worse.
Yeah. We know that he has to go and work with his father at his father's bar, but he's convinced his dad to let him have a 2-hour break so he can go get this coffee with Ophelia. He's made a plan. He's working on it. And then he wakes up. And the first line is, "The bullets have opened 100 eyes in the body, and each one weeps blood. I peer through the lower corner of our curtain at the figure lying face down on the road. All I can think is, did this bastard have to get shot on Saturday?" Holy shit.
Yeah.
This is a violence I didn't expect.
We had already heard those sort of warnings from the taxi drivers, right? Earlier in the story. But you're right. This is shocking to the point where I read that without really fully getting what had happened. Like I had to go back and understand that somebody had been shot to death. And the reaction from Marcus and his mum also implies this isn't the first time. You know, even just the line that you read, that he was saying, "I wish this hadn't happened on Saturday," that tells us that this isn't the first time he's seen a dead body. This isn't the first time he's looked out of his curtains and realized. His mum has to say, you know, "You can't go out because you'll be a witness, and as a witness you are then in danger." You know, these are issues that this family is dealing with. These are issues that this family have dealt with before.
Yeah. It took me a minute to be like, why can't... So I was like, oh, this horrible thing happened. There's a murder outside of his house and then he can't leave. Why? And yeah, because he can't be seen by the gangs or whoever did this murder as someone who's going to snitch to the police. You know, he has to stay inside and not be seen. I think it's also such a shocking moment because, like you said, the family is not surprised or they're not overwhelmed, like kind of I felt like I was as the reader. But also because we're used to Marcus's flowery, poetic language. And so at first it was like, is he being metaphorical? Did he get a call? Did Ophelia, you know, break his heart? But no, we are in the real world. And someone's been killed.
And he even reflects on that himself. He says, "Desperation makes you selfish. It makes the loss of a life abstract when all you want is a woman. So badly you feel her even though you've never touched her." So he knows that he should have more of a visceral reaction, but all he's thinking is, get me out of this house. And he does eventually choose to leave, and he sort of strategically has to work that out for himself. But there's this horrible moment where, again, the descriptions of some of the visceral descriptions of what he is sensing through his mouth, through his taste, like stopped me in my tracks, these descriptions. And we hear, "As I open the door, it is as if I'm swallowing a jar of coins. I never understood why the smell of blood leaves the memory of metal on your tongue." That writing.
The writing. I know some of you listen to this and maybe don't read the story till after, or maybe don't read the story at all. Please, you gotta read this one. I mean, it's just, the descriptions are really unbelievable.
It's so visceral. I feel like I'm completely there. I'm standing side by side with Marcus. Like, and it also just makes me... Obviously, we know he opened the curtains and he could see this body. But how close to this body does he need to be to smell the blood as he opens his front door to the extent that he can taste it on his tongue?
Oh, it's such a good point.
How close to this crime is he? How close to this dead body is he?
You know, before he decides to leave, he's like, maybe I should, you know, text Ophelia and cancel. And he's thinking of things to tell her that would make sense in her world. You know, he says, "My grandfather had a stroke. My mother had an asthma attack. These are problems she will understand." If I tell her I can't leave until the police cart the body off the road, or at least throw a white sheet over it while they interrogate the residents, none of whom will have seen anything, she would probably call the director and demand he change the cast list. Huge gaps. He's still trying to play a part for her, be seen in a certain light for her. He does not want to be seen for where he lives. Of course, this is horrific. This is like an awful thing that's happened. But you see him automatically, one of his first thoughts is, what am I going to do about Ophelia? What am I going to tell her? It can't be this. It can't be the truth.
Yeah. And part of that is around their difference in, they're just the completely different worlds that they live in, and these different, the different class that they live in. But it's also so interesting because this is the same city. They live in the same place. They're part of the same culture, sort of geographically, but they couldn't be in more different worlds. And it's so interesting that the writer has chosen just to pluck these two individuals from two completely different worlds, but like within the same, almost within the same community, and sort of put them together in this play, which is a sort of neutral, creative, beautiful space of you know, the arts. And as soon as they leave that sanctity of the room, they couldn't be further away. And I think she creates that distance and then brings them together in this moment and pulls them apart in a way that it just accentuates the inequity, the unfairness, and the horror that can happen to what feel like two like young, what, teenagers? I mean, the way he talks about her, I'm like, he must be a teenager.
Yeah.
And it just makes so clear that horrible, horrible inequality that is just inescapable for him, to the point where he can touch it, taste it, smell it. He can't escape it.
Yeah. And he gets so close. He gets so close with Ophelia to being able to reach out and kind of cross that divide. But there are real things that stop him from being able to do that. I thought it was interesting, as he's getting ready to leave, he talks about how he, that morning, spent all morning heating water so he could have a warm bucket bath. He could be clean for her. He thinks, you know, Ophelia's family probably has water tanks out there, plenty of water. She'd never notice if the water goes out. Then he says, "And I, who made the effort to be fresh, am being undone by the sun. Sweat soaks my armpits as I walk and walk and walk until I'm finally at my father's bar. I'm both sticky and late." So despite his best efforts, you know, going above and beyond, he's at the bar and he's already not feeling good. He's already feeling dirty and smelly, and he's still got a ways to go before the date.
My God, the bar jobs that he is given, I found this very difficult to read. Like, he had to clean the vomit from the bathroom, and then Braithwaite, worst character of anything I've ever read. Braithwaite makes a small appearance. Braithwaite, who's obviously a drunken man, to come in and like pee right next to Marcus while he's cleaning the toilet, and like just the horror of like the fact that it just goes, you know, it's kind of everywhere and it goes on his shoes.
Oh.
And it's just like, what's happened? Marcus, you were so, like, he tried so hard, and it's just like, he is really, he didn't go and do a bar shift. He's not behind the bar like bantering with locals. He's at a bar where most people are drunk before lunchtime. That's what they said.
Yeah. I mean, that is, what is worse? What is more disgusting than like a midday bar with midday drunks? That's not going to be the people that are keeping the bathroom clean and are being respectful. And they're not, you know?
No.
And he's about to go to the nicest mall in Trinidad to see this beautiful girl, and he's mopping up vomit and bodily fluids, and he's sweaty, and just poor Marcus.
And then we meet this character of Kieran, or Karen, who says that he doesn't need to sort of hustle in this way. What are you doing here cleaning? What are you doing? I could give you $1,000 to go and collect a package, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And you just realize how close, like how close Marcus is to criminality of some kind. We're never told what it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Kieran is a striking figure in the bar. While other people are drunk and slumped over, he is wearing a white Calvin Klein polo and leaning against the bar drinking a Coke. He's not drunk. He's wearing a white t-shirt, which in this environment, in this heat, you know, is a statement of wealth. And you just get the sense that he is different. And when he makes this proposition to Marcus, you're like, you understand innately that this is a criminal act. This is a drug trade. Something's happening here.
And you just think like Marcus is hustling, right? He's hustling. He's resisting. Like you're saying yesterday, he didn't buy a popo because he knew that he needed to save money so that he could meet Ophelia. He's come to do this bar shift because his dad won't give him the money. He says he has to work for the money. His mom has lost her job and is kind of home during the day and collecting rainwater. And you just know that he's hustling Marcus. And so for this offer just to be made for $1,000, like, you know that he's only going to be paid $120 for his whole day of this bar shift. And the coffees are apparently going to cost $25 each. Like,
yeah,
this is an attractive offer. And I'm quite impressed because Marcus kind of dismisses, you know, we don't really, there isn't a sense that he grapples with that at the point where the offer is first made.
Yeah. Unlike the real internal monologues we get about his love of theater, his love of Ophelia. We don't see that with Kieran. All we see is that his father kind of shuts it down and is like, hey, that's my son. That's my bar.
Yeah.
But what we know with Marcus is, yeah, he's been hustling all day in just this one instance. We know he doesn't think his parents are very responsible. He alludes to that a few times.
Yeah.
And so you wonder if a man like Kieran, who's coming in and making this type of presence at the bar, also sees Marcus and sees this kid who is trying, who is working hard and maybe doesn't have the parental support or guidance. And he said, oh, he could be useful. Hate it.
But Marcus does make it to the mall. I mean, he does manage to get out of there just in time to be able to like hustle down to the mall. Obviously, he's not also taken all the way to the mall. I mean, these taxi drivers won't take him to the mall. So he's even kind of more sweaty by the time he arrives. He goes to the bathroom to fix himself up. Also hard relating to Marcus in the bathroom. Just trying to get some of what you had going on when you left the house, when you finally arrive at your date spot. But he's really battling here.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I mean, every date, it's like you're looking in the mirror, you're checking for food in your teeth, you're making sure your clothes aren't stained, and he's like doing his best. What a day he's had. And he's trying to just, okay, get it all together. This is the big moment.
But in order to get ready, he puts soap in his mouth so that he can like clean his mouth.
Yeah. Yeah, we're getting desperate. He's getting desperate. You can see all of his work is like not working. He's breathing into his hand. Like you're saying, we get those smells and tastes from his mouth again. Yeah, he's gargling with soap. I mean,
he's just trying so hard and he's just being completely undone by it. And then he starts to kind of strategize as well. So as well as his sort of physical steps he takes, he says, if I get there early, I can position myself so that my left arm is across my body. That should block some of the worst sweat stains. Will I have to get up when she comes in? God, of course not. This isn't a Victorian novel. A, he's like spiraling. And B, he's like, okay, I can do this. Like he's kind of pumping himself up and talking to himself in this inner monologue, which I also find like very compelling.
Yeah. He says, okay, Marcus, you're okay. You know what you're going to ask her. How was your morning? Learning your lines okay? Me too. I agree. That is the most challenging part of the play. But you would never think it from watching you on stage. And then he kind of comes back and he says, I cup my hands under the tap and drink some water. I feel as if each taste bud is screaming. So he's really hungry. He hasn't eaten.
Yeah.
You know, and he's pretending that he's had all day to practice his lines, which of course he hasn't.
No. And just that like playing ahead the conversation that he wants to have. And like, have you done that? I've 100% done that.
I did it literally yesterday.
Mm-hmm. Oh my God, yesterday. Here she is. What are some of it? What were your practice lines from yesterday?
Oh, what a...
What was going to be your great chat?
Oh, that's such a good question. I have blacked it out now, I think. I was nervous about a date. And I was like, I was doing a little bit of the same thing. Like, it's okay. You're okay. This is going to be fine.
Yeah.
And so I was like practicing asking questions about the things that I knew about this person.
I love that. But we've all done that, I think. Mm-hmm. Like, again, I'm just like, here we are. These moments of like really human, basic, beautiful, funny kind of nervousness about the date, mm-hmm. are smashed up against these experiences that Marcus is having, which are so far away from my reality and so far away from Ophelia's reality that he knows that that's like a chasm that can never be crossed. He wants to kind of lie about where he's from and not kind of have to acknowledge that part of himself. It's such smart writing because mm-hmm. we're kind of, I feel like I'm on Marcus's side, but I'm kind of Ophelia in this situation as well. I feel like I just feel so distanced from Marcus because he's just having all of these experiences that are just so hard and they are so far from the kinds of experience he should be having as this like young guy who's into theater and like likes this girl.
I so badly want Ophelia to see beyond all of this stuff that he's worried about too. And I so badly want, it to be like, Marcus, just be yourself and be you. But he's also just trying to present the best version of himself and he's trying to get to know her and oh, it's so hard. And we see a little bit of foreshadowing mm-hmm. into kind of this ultimate decision he makes at the end. When he says, I've never stolen before, but if only I knew how to get away with it, I would nab a Calvin Klein polo like the one Kieran was wearing. Desperation drains your morality, makes you imagine yourself walking into Hardeen in white cotton, more expensive than anything you've ever owned. Mm. So he's saying, well, you know, Kieran's outfit was what I wish I was wearing. Desperation drains your morality.
It's so interesting because earlier... he says desperation makes you selfish. So this desperateness is sort of changing, you know, it's just chipping away. It's mm-hmm. just chipping away.
He's doing everything he can and it's not getting him any closer to Ophelia. It doesn't feel like for him because then he sees her. He comes out of the bathroom and he sees her sitting at a table for two in the far corner of the room. Waiting. And even when he sees her, she's like a painting. She is wearing a cream dress with wide sleeves that flutter as she turns the page of her book. All the light is whisper soft around her. Her edges blur and bleed like an impressionist painting. Her lips are the inside of a shell, pressing against one another as she reads it, a self-kiss.
Oh,
it's so different from what he's just experienced.
And he can't go.
Mm-mm.
So he sees this sort of vision and he can't do it.
Yeah. He says, how could I ever think I could walk in here and place myself in front of her as if it were a natural thing? We're just staring at each other on Zoom with like sad faces.
Sad faces. It is because it's just like, what do you say? Like we're so behind him for this whole story. And like, it feels like this story is called Ophelia. Like we're waiting for this moment and we don't get it. And he decides he's going to make up an excuse. The same ones he was thinking about earlier in the day and just has to call it off. Which also is like, oh no, it's so much worse to call it off now. She's at the coffee shop already. He says, I apologize to Ophelia and tell her coffee is on me since I wasted her time. And like when we know that that money is like, he doesn't have that money.
Mm-hmm.
And he knows that he, you know, he doesn't even get the coffee that he would have invested in, you know?
Mm-hmm. He's still hungry. And, you know, she's there. She wanted to be there with him. Mm. She wanted to run lines with him.
Yeah.
And he backs away. And in the end, he says, I hope Kieran is still at the bar so I can tell him that I'll pick up the package. No problem. No, Marcus, no.
Yeah. It's like an inevitability somehow, mm-hmm. you know. Like as soon as we met Kieran, it was like on yeah. high alert.
It's such a well-written story. I love the characters. I love the sense of place that the author gives us.
Mm-hmm.
I love it in the way that it broke my heart.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like I know Marcus and I'm with Marcus this whole time. So him missing this date, I feel it too.
Thank you for reading with me, Lizzie.
Thank you for reading with me, Jen.